Children, we're starting.
That's right.
Showtime! Another Fresh Picked Pod from audiotoyou.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
You might wish to stay on and listen.
Hippie Nude Bear, people, or as they say in the classics, Happy New Year. Welcome to Shutters Inc. episode 101. This is Bruce Williams from audio2.com. With me on the line once again, chuckling away from Melbourne via Skype, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Mate, I just thought Bruce Williams was suddenly snapped. There, hang on, we were just talking before we're on air, and suddenly you're going, Hippie Nude Bear, dude. Hippie Nude Bear, I like that. That's cool. I'm really good, mate. I'm really good.
Excellent.
You know, welcome to
2008. We're 3 weeks into it already.
And here we go. Yep, here we go. We're 3 weeks in already. I tell you what, I was thinking about this time last year and thinking, well, that was only a few days ago. Yeah, that's the way it feels sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
And, when we did our last podcast, you know, in 2007, man, that went fast.
Yeah.
It's a good thing I'm young and beautiful, otherwise I'd be really worried.
You know what, talking about how fast time goes by, and stop me if I've told this story already, but a mate of mine...
You've told this story before.
Have I?
No, I'm probably presuming.
A mate of mine said to me only a couple of months ago, we were talking about exactly this, about how we perceive time to go by faster the older that we get. And up until Jamie and I had this conversation, I'd never heard anyone else express this concept, and I thought it was quite valid.
It's the math of it. It's
exactly. He said to me, he said, you know,
when you're 2 years old, one year is half your life.
Yeah.
When you're 40 years old, 1 year is a 40th of your life.
Yeah, I'd never heard that, and I thought that makes a lot of sense.
It's very sad. Yes.
Yeah.
But yes, it is an interesting concept. And I wonder whether, you know, that is what it is, or just we get busier or something. Who knows? But, you know, it's you know, yeah, interesting one. But, you know, we'll just have to take it as it comes, mate. Take it as it comes. We can't really do anything about it. Maybe make our lives less busy and more fun. But then when you're having fun, time flies, they say as well. So I'd say if you really want your year to go slow, don't have any fun. You'll live longer. That's the basic math of it.
Well,
we hope everybody out there in Shutters Inc. land is good, and that you've been taking some time to, you know, grab some great photographs. With our Northern Hemisphere listeners, I imagine you've been struggling maybe with some winter cold and stuff like that, but hoping you've been out there, you know, taking photographs anyway.
I know they've been having some pretty nasty storms on the West Coast in America.
Yeah.
Cold and airports closed down and whatnot.
And here we are down here, you know, on water restrictions.
And you guys have had it pretty hot down there in Melbourne.
We certainly have. I did a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and it was nearly 40 degrees all day. And which was, you know, okay. I'm fairly impervious to heat, and you know, I can, I just put it out of my head, and I just get about doing my job. But I tell you what,
for our American listeners, that's about 112.
Is it? Yeah. yes, that's about it. Yeah. So you're shooting a wedding in that all day, you know, it'll wear on you. But to the, you know, to commend the bride and groom, I didn't hear a single complaint of them all day. And, you know, it was hot, but they made sure they had plenty to drink, and we just made sure we put it out of our heads, and we had a lot of fun in the photos. Yeah, and, boy, I tell you what, you know, I have a no-alcohol policy when I'm shooting a wedding, of course, no matter how many times the groomsman will offer me what we call so beautifully here a crownie, a crown lager. During the day, because they'll pull them out of the eskies, you know.
Yeah.
Have another beer. I just do not drink alcohol when I'm shooting a wedding. I'll have water or some Gatorade or something like that. But I don't mind it once I've packed my gear and I've thanked the bride and groom and I'm heading home as their reception, just after their reception starts. I don't mind actually having a beer with the groom. I tell you what, and the beer on this particular day was the nectar of the gods, because boy, I felt like one at the end of this wedding. So, but it was good, you know, and it was, you have to keep your wits about you in the heat, because you still have to produce the same kind of images you would on a comfortable day.
Yeah.
So, you know, and anybody who's been to my blog will, you know, Flickr site will have seen some photographs from that day. There's a shot I've got of a bride standing in this graffitied wall, just sort of laughing her head off. That was the day. It was 40 degrees.
Wow.
We have had some hot weather down here, and I've got another wedding on this coming Saturday, And they've actually paid me to stay for the reception, so it'll be a long, long hot day. That's okay. A spare shirt and some Rexona, and you know, I'll make sure that I'm all good. But you're shooting a wedding. I tell you what, if you're a wedding photographer out there listening, you know what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Any photographer who poo-poos wedding photographers just has either never done one or just didn't do it very well, because we pour ourselves into our work. It's there one day, and if you're going to respect it, you're going to do and respect yourself. You pour yourself into it, and the conditions are irrelevant. Yeah. You have to pull out the work. You have to make it work. And,
There's no second chance.
There isn't. No, there isn't. You know, and if you've done a few hundred weddings, you can start to become a little blasé, but it's their one wedding. It's their one day, you know, and you've got to look at it that way.
Yep.
So, you know, it's you know, something certainly to consider. But... yeah, that's what we do. I love it still, I must admit. Can't help myself. It's the snag in me.
Excellent.
Well, we've got some interesting things to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's been nice to get a couple of emails from listeners over this slow period. But I tell you what, gang, I'm going to say this. We would love to hear more about what you want to talk about. So, you know, please keep us informed as to what it is that, you know, is in your question box, as it were. And let us help you out. But we did get an email from Mark in Colorado, Littleton, Colorado, and I'll read it out. I love the introduction, Mark, and thank you so much, but, you know, this is not necessary. But he starts off by saying, "Wise Mr. Mueller." Now, of course... you could have saved yourself a lot of spelling and just said Obi-Wan. Right? I mean, that's only six letters, right? So, just next time, Mark, Obi-Wan will do. First, he says, "Thank you for putting out such an informative and entertaining podcast. The Australian flavour and humour make yours my favourite podcast on photography. I know someone of your stature and recognition is always in demand. Surely explaining the infrequency of new shows or perhaps topics are just getting scarce." I didn't know we were infrequent. I thought we were weekly.
I thought maybe we were.
Maybe that's his nice way of saying we're getting a little boring. After listening to all of the shows a couple of times, whoa, this fella's keen.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are two subjects that I would be grateful to you for you to expound upon. I shoot with a DSLR and apply shallow depth of field quite frequently. Good on you. That's fantastic. My brother-in-law has a Fuji S5000 prosumer camera that does not have as pronounced a bokeh for a given aperture and focal length. Does this have to do with sensor size? If so, will a PhD, in brackets, push here dummy camera, be even less able to achieve, I like that, PhD, be even less able to achieve shallow depth of field? You have long suggested a small camera to have with you always, so I'm looking to find one to satisfy my artistic desires. Secondly, would you explain how to convert the small focal lengths and zoom multipliers of these PhD cameras to a 35mm equivalent for comparison? I would be flattered and most appreciative to hear a podcast on these subjects." Well, first of all, yes, it does have a lot to do with sensor size. Because it has to do with the aperture and circles of confusion, the size of the medium compared with the size of the aperture. And so that's why... you have, you know, your aperture size will actually change depending on the size in ancient times of film, making, you know, very large lenses for medium format cameras necessary. But yes, even, you know, my 85mm 1.8, my favorite live-in lens, has more depth of field at 1.8 on my D200 than it would say on my, well, what did I shoot with before, my F90X with a film camera. Because the sensor is actually smaller. It is magnified, the focal length is magnified, but the sensor is smaller, and technically there is a little increase in the, you know, the amount of sharpness. The depth of field does differ with sensor size. The other thing, of course, that you need to think of is that the PhD
camera... Sorry, just to clarify that, are you saying that you get more sharpness from the smaller sensor or less sharpness?
More depth of field. Per aperture. If you're, you know, the aperture is the same, but because the sensor is smaller, you will get more depth of field at 1.8 with, say, an APS-C size sensor than you would with, say, a 35mm size sensor.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
But, you know, what I'd really probably need to consider, and this is just popping into my head at the moment, is the fact that because you've actually magnified the focal length to, you know, effectively anyway, 1.5 or 1.6 times, does it visually actually make a difference? The whole
mathematics... Does it cancel itself out?
Does it cancel itself out? Yeah. Technically, and I know that, Holly, you are asking this question too, does... depth of field differ at the same aperture with different focal lengths? And herein is the argument. Mathematically, apparently, no. Mathematically, apparently, the depth of field is the same with a, you know, 100 millimeter lens as it is with a 28 millimeter lens at the same aperture. But the visual difference, and I will post some photographs, the visual difference is there, that, you know, it does appear sharper. The bokeh does appear sharper than, you know, with a 35 mil lens. The background does appear sharper than it would with the same aperture at a large,
longer focal length.
A longer focal length. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you gave us this as an assignment probably 6 or 8 months ago, or maybe even longer than that now. I don't know.
And in your tests, Bruce, what did you come up with?
Yeah, exactly. That even at, you know, say f4, because at the time I think that was the widest aperture that I had across all of my lenses, so that was the aperture I used, was that f4 on a 300 mil lens certainly gave you a lot more isolation between subject and background than f4 at 28 mil.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But they say that mathematically that's not the case.
Yeah.
But all I know is what I see. I understand, you know, the mathematics when I read them, and I remind myself of them, of, you know, how the circles of confusion work and all that kind of thing. And I avoid that. There are these guys who, you know, they get stuck into all the mathematical stuff. And while I can understand it, I certainly don't bother myself with it. I'm into the visual, the result visually. And all I know is that, first of all, if I'm going to be doing a portrait, I want to use a longer lens anyway. If I want to minimize my depth of field, I have to open the aperture right up. Why do I want to minimize my depth of field? Because the background is distracting, and I want my subject to stand out in the photograph. The, you know, the bokeh, as it were, which is, you know, the effect of the minimal depth of field on the background, varies from lens to lens, and will certainly, you know, and lenses are designed to produce, you know, a lens like an 85mm 1.8, truly a portrait lens, is designed to produce a beautiful soft bokeh and still be sharp at its widest aperture. And so lenses like that are certainly, you know, worth owning if you're a people shooter particularly. Getting under your other question, Mark, about you know, having these all-in-one cameras like the S5000, they're great, they're fantastic cameras. And of course now we've got cameras like the Olympus, you know, 560, which has like an 18 times zoom, and the Lumix, or the Panasonic rather, the FZ18, the Fuji S8000. These cameras have got 18 times zooms in them, and they go from the equivalent of, say, in 35 mil terms, from 28 to 500.
Whoa!
And they're great. I mean, the images they produce are fantastic. We had a cover of a magazine here recently, and I rang the editor, who I know personally, Peter Eastway.
Do you get a tripod thrown in when you buy one of these things?
You get vibration correction in the technology, but, oh, man, you know, yeah, you've got to be very careful.
Man, there'd be few people in the world who could handhold at 500 mil.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that's why they have these, you know, these vibration correction technologies and stuff, you know, built into them. But I mean, look, it'd be a great, if you were backpacking around the world, it'd be a great camera to take with you. There'd
absolutely
be nothing you couldn't shoot with it. And the cover of Better Photography magazine here a couple of issues ago had a stupid picture of it. I mean, and I rang Peter and I said, Peter, the editor of this magazine is an honorary fellow of the Australian Institute of Professional Photographers and the AIPP.
Yeah.
And his work is just, you know, I hate him.
Peter Eastway. Yeah, yeah. Great stuff.
Oh, his work is just beautiful.
Yeah.
And he's the nicest guy in the world, and we're good mates, and I absolutely hate him. His work is beautiful, but he took this picture on the Great Wall of China with the Panasonic FZ18. And It's an 18 times zoom on it and thing. And this picture is incredibly sharp, and it's beautifully exposed, and it's, you know, it's just a stupid picture of a soft toy sitting on the wall of the Great Wall of China. I mean, it's a ridiculously idiotic, no purpose picture. And it was very, you know, he put it on the cover very tongue-in-cheek, I think, which is what Peter would do, because he's a very tongue-in-cheek kind of guy. But the image was incredible. But, of course, these cameras do have their disadvantages, as all cameras do. You know, they all have their pros and cons. What you could not do with a camera like this would be get the same kind of bokeh at portrait length, say 100 or 200 mil, that you could with, you know, a lens, say, like, you know, an 85 or 135 or whatever, because they're designed differently. The sensors are smaller, there is going to be more depth of field, and you can't get the same kind of effect. Things are designed, like, a camera like that is designed to serve a multiplicity of purposes, you know, or as the three in the three amigos, a plethora of purposes. Do you know what a plethora is? They're designed to serve a plethora of purposes, and you can't get that kind of beautiful bokeh from those kinds of cameras. But that's just the way it is. However, there are some cameras, like, for instance, the Ricoh GR, which is my little compact.
My
now dead Ricoh GR.
Oh, what? What happened to it?
Yeah. Did I not explain? I thought I told you when I went away to my photography trip with my friends. I was down on the beach, you know, this rocky coastline with my Ricoh GR, photographing seaweed, photographing big waves as they're splashing.
And you dropped it in.
No. I wouldn't do anything like that. No, but I came home and a couple of days later started the thing up and it just went.
Didn't like the salt air, huh?
I don't think it liked the salt air.
Wow.
No. It's dead. It has died a death. I have built a gravestone and, you know, it is dead. It is an ex-Ricoh. Yes, it has ceased to be. Yes, it's not pining for the fjords. It is dead. And that's such a shame because it's such a gorgeous, gorgeous camera. Ricoh have sent me the GR2 to review, so I'm going to have to see about that.
Very timely.
Very timely, but unfortunately it died. But those cameras, actually, specialist cameras like the GR, the GR2, and I think even, you know, to a degree, the Canon G9, the Capileo GX100, they are actually designed, even though they have wide-angle lenses, they are actually designed to have a beautiful, you know, bokeh. Even though their lenses are wide, they have a nice wide aperture, 2.4, I think the Ricoh GR was, an f2.4, and a lovely bokeh. So I don't know that you'd shoot portraits with it, but when you want minimal depth of field, even with a wide-angle lens, you can still want minimal depth of field sometimes. Mm-hmm. The lens diaphragm was designed so that it really created a beautiful bokeh. So there you go. You can buy cameras and lenses designed to have a really lovely bokeh or softness in the background. It's a very important technique. We've talked about it often here on Shutters Inc. And, you know, how important it is to minimize the depth of field in portrait shooting and maximize for landscape shooting, and to take complete control over depth of field. For those who are new to Shutters Inc., if you've not seen it, have a look at Google my name, Shelton Muller, and go and type in the word next to it, depth of field. The words depth of field next to my name, and it'll take you to my little YouTube presentation. I made this slideshow about depth of field about a year ago, and a friend of mine posted it on YouTube, and it has been, I think it's had about 100,000 hits on the thing, and it explains depth of field and the power of maximum and minimal depth of field. So if you're really wanting to have a look at that, you know, check it out, because it explains the power of it and the reasons why depth of field is so important. I look at the work of a lot of particularly wedding photographers who perhaps maybe are not professionally trained or had a lot of experience. They've got a camera. They head off. They think, I'm going to make some money. I'm going to shoot some weddings. And they head out into the field with their 24-70, you know, zoom, or their 18-70 zoom, or whatever it is they're using, and don't actually have a good portrait lens on them, something that just, you know, they stand away back from the client, from the couple, and they open the lens right up and shoot. And if they don't have a lens like that, the distraction of the background I see in so many images, especially wedding images, and, you know, engagement portraits, couples out, you know, maybe booked a wedding and the photographer throws in the engagement portrait, or, you know, so many of these kinds of couple photograph sessions I see where obviously a medium range focal length lens was used, perhaps a medium aperture 5, 6, or 8 or something like that, and little thought was put into depth of field. And I'm really glad, Mark, that you've raised this question again, because I every image I shoot, unless of course maybe it's a grab, you know, a candid shot right in the middle of, I'm in the middle of something and I'm just grabbing shots as they happen, and that always, that at a wedding particularly, just after the ceremony's finished with all the hugging and the kissing and the families and the tears and the whatnot, I can't think about depth of field too much. I set a preset and bang, 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 I'm grabbing candid shots. But if I'm setting up a photograph, no matter what it is, every image I consider depth of field to be vitally important, whether it be depth of field for you know, minimal distraction, such as a wide aperture in a portrait, or depth of field for maximum sharpness in a landscape. I consider what my aperture setting is for every image, because it will affect the sharpness and it will affect the depth of field. It will affect where the viewer is going to put his eye and what I'm saying. And I don't see that done often enough in portrait and wedding photography. My wife's just come into the room and she's dancing. I just thought I'd interrupt my podcast to say that she's come in and pulling funny faces because she's just walked in and she's just sort of decided to lambaste me. Decided to give me a bit of a, you know, a distraction. So she's dancing here. She's just left. It's okay. I can get my mind back on the subject. you know, when your wife comes into the room and starts dancing, you know, distracted momentarily.
Absolutely.
You know, so, you know, what were we talking about again? Sorry. So depth of field. Yeah, she's thrown me completely. There you go. That's exactly what she wanted to do. So consider depth of field and in whatever you're doing, because as a shooting technique, as a compositional technique, as a means of highlighting the subject, we cannot say enough the power of depth of field in your images. Choose your apertures wisely.
Both you and I shoot almost 99% of the time in aperture priority. I know I do.
Yeah.
You the same?
I probably choose aperture priority as an automatic mode more than any other.
Yeah.
I shoot a lot manually.
Yes.
Yep. And, you know, but I probably aperture priority mode a lot of the time.
But if you're doing a wedding where you don't generally want to be sitting there doing manual all the time, I'd be on aperture more often than on anything else.
Yes. I also choose my lenses when I buy them, you know, so that I can have the option of a wide aperture, and that's more expensive, but usually those lenses are better designed optically, because the maker of the lens knows that people will be shooting at the wide aperture that they're given to shoot, and they have to actually design the lens better optically to make sure that at those wide apertures, you know, we don't have softness at the edges, you know, or too much, you know, aberration, spherical aberration, chromatic aberrations. So when you buy a lens with a wide aperture, it's designed for professionals and it's designed to shoot brilliantly at a wide aperture. So you can imagine what it does at a medium range aperture like f/8. You know, it's going to knock your socks off. But I don't think I've ever taken my 80-200 2.8 off 2.8.
I mean,
I doubt I have. I know I've shot a couple of times with my 85 at an aperture other than 1.8. But if my 85mm lens was a living thing, it'd be saying, what do I need all these other apertures for most of the time? Because they're lenses that are designed for that purpose. Well, that's why I bought them anyway. I mean, I very rarely take them off these wide apertures because they are so impressive. You know, they do things the human eye can't really do, and that's why it makes the difference. And I go back to what we were saying before. I've been wandering around Flickr and other sites looking at the work of particularly wedding photographers. I have a thing for wedding photography because I know the demands placed upon a photographer on a wedding are incredible. And I respect pro, really good wedding photographers immensely, you know, because they're the Jerry Gahonises and your Van Zanzanians of this world and the Martin Shembrys of this world. I respect their work incredibly because on a wedding, man, you got to think fast. You're working in all sorts of terrible situations, very difficult circumstances. You got to pull out magic images. But I see a lot of try-hard wedding photography where, you know, they want to take it easy on themselves. So they've got one camera, one lens combination, and they shoot the whole wedding with that. And I just don't think that works because you need to have some images in your wedding that, you know, are just, you know, long lens, wide aperture, distracting, not, you know, completely blown out, non-distracting background. And when you produce that shot, your couple just goes, hello, because they don't know what it is about the image. They just know that it knocks their socks off. You know, in this 40 degree shoot the other day, I got out my 80-200 heavy lens, 80-200 2.8, and, you know, I put it on my camera, and, you know, I walked down the alley. We were in an old alleyway in Flinders Lane in Melbourne. I walked down the alleyway quite a few yards, zoomed right into 200 at 2.8, and photographed them. They didn't know why I walked so far away. I knew what I had to do.
Yeah.
But I knew that was the effect that I needed to create. I love the idea of the graffiti. I love the idea of the old laneways and the brick walls and all the old rotten old piping and everything. It was fantastic. But while I loved it, I knew that it had to be secondary to the subject. It had to be something you saw but didn't see.
And didn't so, focus on. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's in focus, it's going to distract.
I mean the viewer. You don't want the viewer focusing on it.
Exactly. Yeah. And if that's what I mean. If it's in focus, it's going to distract.
Yeah.
And only that which you want the people to look at should be in focus. So I made it out of focus. It's there in the image. You can see where they are and you can see what's behind them, but it's only. So, you know, Mark, you've raised this very important subject, you know, wisely, because we've talked about it a lot here, and yet still I see far too many people employing or not considering, rather, the importance of the power of depth of field, whether it be minimal or maximum in their images. So, yes, to make a long story short, you are going to have difficulty, producing a beautiful bouquet with a camera like, you know, a prosumer version of like the S5000 that you mentioned. Some are better than others, perhaps, but they're not really designed for that kind of thing. Only with the DSLR that you shoot with, Mark, are you going to be able to really control depth of field, because you'll be able to control the lens you buy and how it was designed. They are important factors to consider, but perhaps we can have some, what do you reckon, Bruce, some interaction from our listeners on this subject.
Yeah.
On the subject of bokeh, on the subject of maximum and minimum depth of field, and perhaps things that they do to create interesting bokehs for themselves. There is, you know, a technique whereby you you actually can create your own bokeh by opening your aperture right up. And if you've got a Coke and filter holder, you get a black bit of cardboard, and you draw a heart shape. You create a little heart shape in your in a black bit of cardboard. Cut it out, and you put it in front of the lens, and you shoot all day, or shoot some portraits with that, and all your little highlights in the background will be heart shaped.
Okay.
Give that a try, because the highlights.
How big should this cutout heart be in relation to the size of your?
Therein is the experiment. Yeah, therein is the experiment, and will depend on the lens. But I mean, if you had an 85mm 1.8, I would estimate, I don't know, the heart should be about a centimeter and a half across. That's just a guess.
So around about a fifth or a sixth of the diameter of the lens?
Well, I'm just doing some basic math in my head, and you always come up with these crazy questions live on air that I've got to answer. But having seen it done, I would estimate that, you know, maybe 15 mil across or something like that. 15, maybe try 20. Mm-hmm. Just a thought. It'd be something you'd have to experiment with.
Right.
But what it does is, see, the highlights will always assume the shape of the diaphragm in your lens.
Yeah.
Right? But if the if you've opened your lens right up, and then you've put something of a different shape in front, that is your new aperture, really. And a test that you could do would be the size of the little shape that you've made, and also how it is affected by various aperture choices. In fact, at 1.8 and 85mm, it may not register at all because it's just too close, right? So if you close down the aperture, what happens to that? I'm going to maybe give that a try myself. But it will assume the shape of the heart. If you wanted to be really kitschy, you know, and create romantic portraits, make your bokeh highlights heart-shaped. See what happens. Because it will assume the shape of that which has now become the aperture. So that's just an interesting thought. But, you know, lenses are designed to create, you know, they will put more shutter or diaphragm blades, rather, in an aperture to create, you know, a more pleasing bokeh. All these things are designed in lenses so that you get that. So make your own and see what you come up with as a bit of a test. And let's see if we get any takers on that.
Want to see some submissions on this over the coming week, people?
Yeah, let's see if we can, you know, see if we can get the... I can see Bruce now getting out his black cardboard. He's drawing his little heart shape. He's going to, you know, throw it on his lens, see what happens.
Yeah.
I probably won't get time over the next week to do that myself, but it'd be interesting to, you know, or I'll see if I can get a chance. Hey, I've got a wedding on Saturday. Because I've never actually done it. I've only ever seen it done. This is me being, you know, very, very honest. But I have seen it done. I have seen the results, and I think it'd really be worth a try. Seeing as we are talking about bokeh, what we can come up with. I mean, you might want to design a different shape altogether. A rectangle, an octagon, whatever, a star. You know, a little, a star-shaped bokeh. See what you come up with, and see how the highlights, you know, in your image are affected by the shape that you make your aperture. It's a good lesson, because what it teaches us is that, you know, the lens we buy and how it's designed will make a dramatic effect on the image that we produce. So certainly worth talking about. Ooh. I'd really love some interaction. I'd really love everybody to get back to me on this subject, because it's something that we've talked about a few times. And I think for many Shutters Inc. listeners, it's been a bit of an epiphany, because I know when I learned it, you know, many years ago, when I learned the power of minimal depth of field in portrait work, I just went, Oh, heck, is that how they do it? What happens now if I make my lens even longer, but use, you know, and I just went, this is fantastic. You know, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And I was only in my late teens, but I just thought, wow, you know, this is incredible. And ever since then, it has just been something that I have absolutely loved and never tired of using in my portraits, which is why I have a 180mm, you know, macro lens, and an 80-200 2.8, my live-in lens, my 85 1.8. Anything ever happened to these lenses, I just go out and get another one.
Yeah.
You know, my first lens to give me that kind of effect that I bought secondhand for $240, because he didn't know what he had, was a 180mm Nikkor 2.8.
Oh, wow.
And I bought it for $240 secondhand. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And he just didn't know what he had on the shelf, the poor bloke. Yeah, I'll have that, mate. Yeah, no worries. Thanks. Yeah. No, my guard. No, I'm not going to argue with you on the price. I'll just have it. Fine. And I learned from using that lens, and it was just a gorgeous lens. In fact, yeah, just a beautiful lens, sharp as a 2.8. But I learned from that lens the power of what could be done with a long lens and a wide aperture. If you haven't got one, go out and get one. If you're a wedding and portrait shooter, you need one. You cannot live without one, and you're mad if you don't carry one around. You're absolutely crazy.
Yep.
If you don't go out and see what you can do to get hold of one of these. It's the effect is incredible. So there you go.
Excellent.
That's now, I need your help, gang. I really need your help, because we're now on episode 101. Is that right, Bruce?
Yep.
101, and thank you, Mark, for, you know, saying we need to talk about this. I'd love to talk about whatever you want to talk about. We will probably start going back through some of the old shows and expounding on things that we talked about before, so that if we have new listeners, they don't need to go back, and old listeners can be reminded. But if you've got some new ideas, we'd certainly love to hear about them. One thing while I'm here, Bruce, we got a few more minutes?
Yeah.
On a wedding that I was on a couple of last Saturday was.
Yeah.
It was a very warm day, and the bride and groom wanted to go down to Mornington Beach. And Mornington is a lovely place, got a beautiful pier that everybody fishes off of and a red rocky coastline. But it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, we're on daylight savings here in Melbourne, and it's summer. So I had this beating, blasting sun. Yeah. Oh, and I thought, what am I going to do? I have seen too many bad wedding photos taken on the beach in the bright midday sun with photographers not knowing why on earth their pictures, you know, aren't turning out romantically because this hard beating sun. And of course the bride and groom don't know what that photographer has to deal with. All they've seen is these gorgeous warmly lit beach shots, and they think that, you know, it doesn't matter what time of day you go there and la 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 la. But this is where we found ourselves, and what can I do? But I tell you what saved me was my off-camera flash. What I got the bride and groom to do was climb down the rocky coastline. All right, down you go. I stood above them, and I used my off-camera flash and a stop or two of underexposure to create a more interesting effect. And just for those, because we've talked a lot about this recently, who haven't given it a try yet, it saved me. Otherwise, I just would have had an awful, awful situation. But I created my own shape, my own lighting, my own form by underexposing the ambient light a stop or two, and then using my off-camera flash fairly close to the subject to actually light the face and give the face its own, you know, shape and form and dimension, like a bit of outdoor Rembrandt lighting, as it were, or outdoor broad lighting, or whatever I've employed. It was my salvation, and it was just, I thought, boy, I had to think on my feet right there and then to come up with how I'm going to save myself from this awful situation. And that's what I came up with, off-camera flash with, underexposure in the ambient, and it worked. It really worked. You can go to the Flickr site and have a look at a couple of my
blog. Yeah, I'm just looking at the shot of Nicole now.
Yes, yes, pretty girl. Mm. Very, very pretty girl. And she actually, the moment I met her, she reminded me of Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
You should see her smile. She's the spitting image of Sandra Bullock, but brunette. That's what saved me was the off-camera flash. If you're looking at the one of her just grabbing her dress, she was actually just walking back up, and she just grabbed her dress, and I said, oh, look over your shoulder, and she just looked. I had the camera off in my I had the camera in my right hand, the flash in my left hand, and a couple of stops of underexposure on the ambient so I could retain some detail.
Yeah.
And bang. And that shot's had 400 views.
Nice.
That's nice. Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
But that's what saved me, you know. And I used the S5 on that shot too. The Fuji S5.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought, if I need some extra dynamic range, this will be the place where I'll need it. So, that's my favorite shot is the one down of her on the bed, leaning on the bed. I love that shot of her.
Oh, yep.
The one that's the both of them, the close up and the further away shot.
Yeah.
But just if you're in that situation and you've got the opportunity to use your flash off camera to light and create your own shape and form and texture, off camera flash is really becoming my new baby. Depth of field used to be my new baby, but now that's my old baby. I got this new thing, got this new love going on. So, I just thought I'd share that before we signed off.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for that.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm looking forward to getting back into the swing, getting back on Shutters Inc. Flickr site again. But I also really need you guys to get back into the swing with us. Let us know what you want to talk about. Think about it this way. You're on a shoot. A problem presents itself. And you think, ooh, how do I overcome this problem? Maybe you didn't overcome it that well. Well, present the problem to me. Present the problem to me, and if I can fix it for you, if I can put myself in that situation, then we'll talk about it. Because I'm sure you're not alone. I'm sure look, I had a problem on Saturday. How did I had to think on my feet to overcome this problem. That's what photographers do. And I want to know what situations you've been in, how you handled it. Did it work? Did it not work? And then we can talk about overcoming those problems. Photographers are problem solvers. That's what we are, problem solvers.
Yep.
So, you know, let me know where you've had a real hard time achieving an image, and let's see what we can do to maybe solve that problem next time you find yourself there. You won't be alone, I tell you.
Absolutely.
All right, mate, thank you very much for that.
No worries, my pleasure.
Remember, you can email Shelton, shelton@audiotou.com. You can email me, studio@audiotou.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to see some submissions of those homemade bouquets.
Let's see how we go. It'll be interesting to see what you've come up with.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give it a try myself on my wedding this Saturday, I reckon. Make myself a little bouquet.
Beautiful. You know,
instead of saying, instead of asking the bride, where's your bouquet? I'll have my own.
All right, mate. Talk to you next week.
You bet. See you soon.
Bye.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.